If you could sit down with one person for an hour-long conversation, who would you choose? That's always an interesting question. An historic figure? A business titan? A celebrity? A famous athlete? Introducing Jeff Benedict, a best-selling author who gets to do just that with every project he tackles. Whether writing the definitive biography of Tiger Woods or the autobiography for Steve Young, this week's Game Face exec invites us into the huddle of his latest bestseller, The Dynasty, an unfiltered look into the most dominant sports organization of the 21st century, the New England Patriots. It's such an honor and a privilege to be able to talk to Jeff Benedict today, a New York Times bestselling author, a very prolific writer, a keen observer of society and of a variety of industries. And Jeff and I met many years ago as he was actually working on a project, which was a funny story how we met. We'll probably have to save that for another conversation. But Jeff is based on the East Coast, and he's taken time from his busy promotional schedule as The Dynasty, his latest bestseller, has just been published by Simon & Schuster. And Jeff is definitely on the circuit right now, meeting with all kinds of media, but he's agreed to take some time away from his busy schedule to visit with me in Game Face Exec's podcast and our audience. So welcome, Jeff.
Hey, welcome, Rob. It's great to be on with you and to reconnect with you.
Yeah, it really is. You're going so many different directions, and it was fun just before the camera started rolling here just to kind of find out what's going on in your life. But with all the busyness around this great new book, The Dynasty, that you put together, I'm sure our listeners and our viewers are really interested in knowing kind of the genesis of writing this book about this historical dynasty called the New England Patriots. So can you just kind of walk us through that process, when it began, what was the motivation or the inspiration behind it? And I'm sure we'll dig further into it.
You know, it's the answer to that, Rob, is actually part of sort of a personal journey question. About, you know, probably 7 years ago at this point, I started working with Steve Young on his autobiography. And for me, it was like a wonderful opportunity to write a biography about someone that I had admired since I was a kid, and also to write about someone who I believed is excellent in his class, like one of the greatest quarterbacks who's ever played in the NFL. And while Steve and I were working on his biography, I remember one Monday night, we were in New England because as an ESPN broadcaster, he was covering a Monday night football game in Foxborough, and I was tagging along working on the book with him. We were standing on the sideline in Gillette Stadium before the game, and owner Robert Kraft came out and was talking to Steve. Robert admires Steve a lot, as most people do in the business. And Steve admired Mr. Kraft. And Steve also has a really great friendship and connection with Tom Brady. And as we were standing there, I'm from New England, and I was thinking, here we are in the home of the greatest sports dynasty of my generation and probably of the 21st century. And I'd just been thinking there's a book here about excellence and how to build success. But I went from Steve Young to then doing Tiger Woods' biography. And Tiger Woods is certainly the greatest golfer who's ever lived. And it was so here was another book about someone who was first in class and who had built this tremendous successful reputation in the industry of golf. So doing the Patriots was sort of the third in line of a succession of books about, in this case, not a biography about a quarterback or a golfer, but really a biography about an organization that has thrived on excellence for the last 20 years and been so dominant in their industry. I just wanted to know, how did they build this dynasty, this winning machine? And then secondly, Rob, how did they sustain it for so much longer than any of their predecessors? And I thought by getting to the owner, the coach, and the quarterback, who are the three components or the nucleus of that winning tradition, there was a lot to learn there about basically about how to succeed.
Well, those three components, if I can, those three levels of an organization, ownership, and then management or the person who's coaching an organization, and then those who are responsible for executing, the people on the field.
That's very familiar to those of us in the business world or the nonprofit world, where we have a board of directors, we have an executive director, we have people in the field. So I'm sure there are a lot of lessons that we can and will learn from reading The Dynasty. Can you give us some insight into some things that you learned by going into that exploration of this historic franchise that you have found are transferable across industry?
Yeah, I can. I chose to open the book with a scene that most people reading what they assume is a football book are surprised by, which is a scene that takes place in 1962 when Robert Kraft is in his early 20s. He's still in college at Columbia. And his nickname at that point is Bobby. He's not Mr. Kraft or Robert Kraft. No one knows who he is. And he walks into a diner in Boston after midnight, and he's got his buddies, and they're looking at the menu board, thinking about what they're going to eat. And he's looking at a pretty girl in front of him in line and trying to figure out, how can I get her to go on a date with me? And the reason I open with that scene is because within 24 hours, not only is he get her to go on a date with him, she proposes marriage to him. And it's such an unthinkable, unfathomable situation. I use that as an illustration to say that if you look at what happened in that 24 hours between when he met her in the diner and when she proposed to him a day later in his car, it's a roadmap to what he's going to build in New England as the owner of the most successful franchise. And it starts with this. It's the gift of persuasion. And that's not, you know, that's something that's so easily overlooked, but he's not forceful. He doesn't try to muscle his way into things. He has a great gift of building relationships, doing it quickly, establishing trust. Then I sort of springboard from there to his very unconventional decision to hire Bill Belichick as his head coach, which, if you look back, when Robert Kraft did that, all of the so-called experts in the National Football League were telling him that this would be the biggest business mistake of his career, that hiring Bill Belichick would be something he'd regret for the rest of his life. He didn't listen to any of the experts. He had an instinct that there was something different about Belichick because he'd studied him and watched the way he teaches the game of football and the way young players responded to him. And he trusted his instincts and he hired him to be a head coach. And then third, he allowed Belichick the latitude and the discretion to make a decision that was very controversial at the time, which was to draft a quarterback that no one else wanted and that everyone else thought wasn't suitable to succeed in the NFL. And Belichick picks a guy named Tom Brady. And then he does something even more controversial, is he goes with Brady in the lineup over the $100 million superstar quarterback Drew Bledsoe that was on the roster at the time. And to Kraft's credit, despite how badly he wanted to intervene and force his coach to not do that, he allows him the discretion and the latitude to make the executive decision. He supports him in it. In other words, he gives him the ability to fail. And of course, he doesn't fail. This proved to be a genius move. And all of these things are the beginning. This is the foundation of building a dynastic sports organization. The relationship between the owner and the coach, which is a relationship of trust, of transparency, and of reciprocity. It's a back and forth trust relationship. And then the relationship between the owner and the quarterback, which is more of a familial relationship. It's more like a father and a son, because the owner recognizes if you look at Tom Brady like an asset, he is the most important asset on the field. And so the owner wants a relationship with him that isn't just business. He wants a closer connection to him, an investment that's more personal. And that's what helps keep Brady in New England for 20 years. And so those are the sort of things when I get into the early part of the building of the dynasty, these are the fundamental building blocks of building a successful sports organization. To me, Rob, if you want to look at what separates the Patriots from the Yankees, the Celtics, the 49ers, the Golden State Warriors. This is it.
Wow, that's fascinating. So first of all, we appreciate your not only recognition, but your acknowledgement of the role that persuasion plays in success. Because as you know, Game Face Execs podcast celebrates the power of persuasion and influencers, people who can inspire and motivate us to do great things. Now, in that story that you're telling, I'm curious, was every move that Bob Kraft made and Bill Belichick, was every move perfectly orchestrated? How much of it was just gut instinct? How much of it was just judgment? And how much did you find was just, you know, flat out luck?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, and I think this is to me really important, is there were setbacks and failures and times where, like right now, we look at the Patriots and all we think about is winning, because for 20 years they've been so dominant. People forget this organization used to be the worst team in professional football, both on and off the field. In other words, their performance on the field was the worst in the league. And then in terms of how they were managed and their financial condition was also the worst in the league. When Robert Kraft bought the team in 1994, the Patriots Stadium had gone into bankruptcy. The team was on the verge of bankruptcy, and they had the worst record over the previous decade in the NFL. It wasn't as if everything was smooth from the outset. And I think this is an important point, is in the first 3 years that Kraft owned the team, his head coach was Bill Parcells, who at the time was considered the greatest coach in football. And I think he was the greatest coach in football. But he and Kraft did not get along at all. There was not a smoothness to that relationship. There was a tremendous amount of friction. And the reason I bring that up is because for all the trouble that they had and the difficulties and the arguing and the bickering, which ultimately led to Parcells resigning and walking away from the team, it's that 3 years of problems that really set the stage for the 20 years of greatness between Kraft and Belichick. In other words, there was a learning curve. This didn't just happen smoothly and easily. Kraft went through a very steep and rough learning curve with Parcells that enabled him to do things differently with Belichick and helped him learn the industry and also learn what kind of owner he wanted to be, and helped sort of refine his management style with Belichick. And so I went to great lengths in the book to point out the learning processes, because similarly, when Belichick gets there, people forget that before he coached New England, he coached in Cleveland, where his record was a losing record. He was fired in Cleveland because of his record. And then he comes to New England, and his first year in New England, he has a terrible season. It's 5-11. And so they learn and grow into who they are. You could even make the analogy with Brady. That's similar. So I think it's important for people to see that success comes through learning, through setbacks, through hardship. But these guys grind through those and use those experiences to build on and learn from.
You know, you're also describing individuals that are fallible and that were not perfect. And in fact, in the case of Tom Brady, most people thought he was just an afterthought in the draft. If you go back and watch his combine tapes when he was trying out, I mean, he doesn't even look like he belongs on the same field as most of those college draft picks, because he was slender and, you know, just kind of a tall, skinny, almost looked like a weak guy. So my question is, they're putting together the dream team, if you will. It's certainly its skill, its ability, but there's also got to be some chemistry, and there's got to be a personality that's conducive to teamwork. I think about the old adage about why this is several years ago, maybe decades ago now. There was a study done as to why airplanes crash, putting aside the mechanical issues. And they said that the biggest reason for airplanes to go down is lack of teamwork in the cockpit. And so I wonder about the Patriots organization. Did you find that there was just a unique chemistry that you had to have the right personalities at the right place to create this kind of teamwork mentality that allowed them to work through some of their physical limitations or even, you know, some of their setbacks? And certainly they didn't come in. None of them came in with a track record of success. They had to build it together.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting, Rob, is in sports, as is the case in many industries, where particularly when people reach the top of their respective industries, there are huge egos in professional sports. In fact, if you don't have a big ego, you can't make it in professional sports. And so Belichick and Brady are, you know, without question, the two biggest, brightest stars that have been on the NFL stage for the last two decades, really since the turn of the century. I think one of the genius moves by Kraft, the owner, is he recognized early on that he had basically John Lennon and Paul McCartney on his payroll. And his whole approach as an owner became focused on sort of minimizing his own ego, because owners have egos too, and they're huge. He suppresses his by putting the focus on his two stars and thinking solely about, how do I keep these two guys married for longer than Joe Montana and Bill Walsh, or longer than Terry Bradshaw and Chuck Knoll? Because he knew that when they were together, even though the quarterback and the coach don't have a personal relationship away from business, they're not close, but they have a chemistry on the field that's unparalleled. And so for the owner, it's all about how to keep them together. And that's not easy, especially as the years wear on and the Super Bowl championships pile up. It gets harder and harder to keep those two egos, those two very different personalities, working together on the same stage. And I think one of the things that has been severely overlooked in all of this is the role of Tom Brady, the quarterback, being willing to endure harsh criticism, browbeating that the coach would administer in his effort. Now I'm talking about Belichick, in Belichick's effort to coach everybody the same way, to not treat anybody different. Bill Belichick does not believe in a star system. Even though he had the biggest star in the league on his team, he does not believe in a star system. And so as Tom Brady's star continued to grow, Belichick would pound him even more in practices and team meetings. For other players, even star players like Randy Moss and Teddy Bruschi and Willie McGinnis and all of these guys who played for the Patriots, to see Tom Brady not only endure these kinds of criticisms and barbs, but to just basically ignore it and perform even harder, it forced all of the other players to get in line behind Tom and to allow themselves to be coached the way he was being coached. I really believe that, and I say this in the book, that Peyton Manning, John Elway, Dan Marino, Aaron Rodgers, Brett Favre, you name it, none of those great quarterbacks, I think, would have been able to take or would have put up with what Tom Brady put up with for 20 years. It's absolutely integral to the success that Belichick and the Patriots have in that system, the Patriot way. You had to have a leader, a star, who was willing to basically be humble enough to put up with this and do it for the good of the team. And obviously it benefited Brady because he won six championships, and it benefited the team and the organization.
Well, that's a fascinating insight, because you don't think of humility when you think of professional athletes, or frankly, right, anyone at the top of their industry.
Right.
And I have to ask you, as you wrote the book, did you have pretty clear free rein with these three subjects that we're talking about right now? Were they cooperative with you in granting you interviews?
So as a whole, the Patriots organization was, you know, I can't say enough about the access and the cooperation, starting with the owner and the executives that run the team all the way down. And I did have access to both Robert and Jonathan Kraft, the team president, to Tom Brady, to Bill Belichick, and to many of the others, you know, other key players, whether it's Rob Gronkowski, all the way back to Drew Bledsoe. The levels of access and participation varied from person to person. But I thought that, you know, Brady's participation particularly, you know, I'd been told in advance, you know, Tom isn't going to say much. Don't expect a lot from those interviews. I have to tell you that he was, in my opinion, some of the best interviews that I've ever done as a journalist were with Tom. He was very forthcoming, very insightful. For me, it was like, you know, going to school, listening to Tom talk about his approach as a quarterback, as a father, as a husband. I mean, it was a really three-dimensional view of him, which I thought enabled me to do things as a writer that I don't usually get to do with someone. And Kraft was the same way, both Krafts. In Belichick's case, he was typical Belichick in the sense that, you know, he wanted all of his questions written down and submitted in advance, which, by the way, I tend to do that a lot anyways, because I find that I get better answers from people when they have chance to think about the questions in advance. So I would have done that anyways, is my point. But after he read all the questions, Coach Belichick decided he wanted to answer them in writing, which that's not something that was new to me. I've had people do that in the past. And my experience is when people actually take the time to write out answers, because it takes longer to write an answer than to speak an answer, like we're doing right now, you tend to get more thoughtful responses from people because they're forced to really think about what they're writing down. And that proved to be the case with Coach Belichick. The answers that he provided in writing were very insightful. They were thought out. They were articulate, as you would expect from someone like him. And so I would say, you know, the short answer to your question is that I thought that their input and participation was tremendous. And it really did enable me to convey to the writer the perspective of all three men sort of through their own eyes, instead of me putting my gloss on it. This is really what they said and thought and did.
As you have now interviewed many famous, successful athletes and people of other industry, I would say, just for our listeners' sake, two in particular that I'd like to ask you about. One is Tom Brady, or actually two together, Tom Brady and Steve Young, two Super Bowl champion quarterbacks who led, one could argue, dynasties in their own era. What's something similar between those two individuals, Steve Young and Tom Brady, that you could look at and you could say, you know, if I was raising a son or a daughter right now, these are qualities that those two gentlemen had that I hope my son or my daughter or my grandson or my granddaughter could have?
That's a great question, Rob, and one that I have actually, the subject matter you're now taking us into is something that has been on my mind for years. It goes back to, I'll answer this with preface my answer with this little anecdotal story. When I was working on Steve Young's autobiography, one day we were in San Francisco and I was a passenger in Steve's car. And we were driving through San Francisco during rush hour. It was very busy. He was going to a speaking engagement for a business audience and I was riding along. And I remember two things. I couldn't believe how he was driving in traffic, talking, doing all these things. And I was just like, his peripheral vision and reflex was almost unnerving. But as we were driving, I said to him, I remember this vividly. I by that point, I had developed so much respect for Steve as a man, as a husband, as a father. Forget the football accomplishments. This was just being around him enough to see at his core who he was as a human being and being really attracted to those qualities. And saying to him that at that point, there was only one other athlete that I could think of that I was really interested in writing a book about, and that was Tom Brady. And I brought that up to him because, first of all, I knew that he and Tom were friends. And secondly, because they're both quarterbacks. And I was seeing what I thought might be some parallels in their lives. Now, the fact was, at that time, I didn't know if those parallels truly existed. I was just sort of making some assumptions. Well, now that I've written The Dynasty, I can say that those are not assumptions. They're facts. The parental approach that Tom and Steve take is, it's almost identical in the way they approach their roles as fathers and also their roles as husbands. And it's rare, I believe, in my experience, and as you said, I have been around the sports industry for a long time. I've been around a lot of athletes, and I'm just saying that Steve and Tom stand out for this, for the fact that both of them reached the pinnacle of their sport. And at one time, in Steve's case, he was on top of the world. He was the face of the NFL. He literally had his face on milk commercials and shoe commercials and everything else. He was that guy. And Tom is that guy today and has been for the last 20 years. It's really hard when you're in that position and the spotlight is on you all the time and anything you want is at your beck and call. It's hard to stay grounded. It's hard to really sort of maintain the fact that the most important thing in my life is my marriage and my kids. Tom Brady and Steve Young are these great examples of two guys who have always understood that and always remain grounded like that. And so being around them, it wasn't just the chance to interview and sort of profile two of the greatest quarterbacks who've ever played the game. But off the field, when I look at them as men, I saw this in both of them. There's, again, that word humility. There's a humility about them when you first meet them that comes through. When I first met Tom Brady, it was in his suite at the stadium, at Gillette Stadium, and it was my first interview with him. And when the minute he came in the room, there was a personal touch about him that, he treated me like a friend, even though I wasn't at that point. I was a stranger, but that wasn't faked. It was authentic. And then it just sort of grew from there. And so to me, there's a lot to learn from people who get to that point in their life and they still remember to say thank you to the janitor or they still remember to just show kindness to the person who is carrying a flashlight on the day of the game and making sure they get safely from the field to the tunnel. They think of people like that. And I can't tell you how many times I was with Steve Young during his book where we'd walk into a stadium before a Monday night game and all the stadium staff, the security guards, the people who sweep the stadiums, who would say to me, because they knew I was with Steve, I love that guy. And I'd say, why do you like him so much? And they'd say, because when he was a player and he came to this stadium, he would actually stop and say hello to me. No one else did that. Those little things are great portals into who these guys are.
That's fascinating. I think too, Jeff, for me, knowing who you are really means that you understand who others are. Yeah. You understand the value of other people. And if you understand who other people are in the grand scheme of things, it gives you such clarity as to who you yourself are. But I have to ask you, and not to try to create a controversy here, but it seems today in this society of social media and everyone's got a point of view and there's so many outlets to express that point of view, narcissism is almost rewarded. In other words, look at me, hear what I have to say. And I'm wondering, as a writer, as an author, as an investigator like you are you finding that it's easier to get popular subjects? And I'm speaking, when I say subjects, of people, personalities. Is it easier to get them to open up because that's the way society is today? Or has this ubiquitousness of information caused people to kind of withdraw and be more guarded when they see someone like you waiting to interview them?
I think just even aside from the issues you raised, which by the way, I agree with the way you frame this, I think that's an accurate assessment of where we are right now in culture. So I agree with that premise. But in terms of answering this particular question, I think there's an underlying difficulty, even without what you just said, to get people who have had great success in athletics or anywhere else to open up and talk to a journalist or someone like that. And there's a lot of reasons for why that is. One basic one is that people want to tell their own story and not have somebody else sort of putting their gloss on my story. And so there's that. And then there's also just sort of the fear factor of how is this stranger going to portray me? And that's valid. Like if the roles were reversed, I would be concerned about that. And so I always think about that when I approach people about doing a story about them or writing a book, is I understand that concern and I try to see it from their perspective and try to put people at ease. Rob, in fact, the first time I interviewed Tom Brady, one of the things I said to him at the outset is I said, I have a lot of questions to ask you, some of which I'd sent to him in advance. But my point was at the outset, as we're getting acquainted, is to say, look, if there's anything here that I ask that you don't want to talk about, just say so. We'll move on to the next one. And I will not interpret that as to mean that there's something here that's, scandalous or anything else. I won't put any negative connotation on the fact that you don't want to discuss that. It doesn't matter why you don't want to discuss it. The fact is, it's a privilege to just to be able to talk and have an interview with you. I want you to be comfortable. And so if I want to go into an area that you don't want to go into, you just say, I'd rather go to the next question. And we'll, without further ado, we'll move to the next question. Because it's not about, for me, I'm not trying to do a gotcha interview with anybody. I'm really just trying to learn and obtain information and put people at ease that way. So that's sort of how I go about it. I think that this, when you talk about social media and the narcissism and all that, in a way, strangely enough, that has actually benefited me to a certain extent, because I don't have a big social media presence by design. I don't like social media. I don't have millions of followers on Twitter. I don't, break news on social media. In fact, it's not in my best interest to do that, because I'm a book writer. I often learn things and then have to sit on them for 2 years because I don't want to talk about them until my book is out. So I'm sort of trained and conditioned to not go on social media and blab about things. It requires me to have a lot more discretion and patience. That actually is beneficial when I'm trying to convince someone to talk to me, because I have a record and a reputation that says this guy isn't going to run out of this interview and post something on Twitter, because it's actually would work against what I'm trying to do. And so I just soon keep it that way, because I'm trying to build rapport with people and make people comfortable to talk to me about things that they may not have discussed with a reporter in the past.
Man, there's so much in what you just said, Jeff, that I'd love to explore with you. Let me see if I can unpack just a little bit of it, not all of it. But first of all, this notion that you have to build trust with your subjects, so critical. And I'm wondering, as an author, are you concerned at all about the proliferation of social media, the proliferation of, let's pick on a platform for now, of Twitter, where someone can immediately tweet out something they just heard or something they saw, or sometimes worse, something they just thought, and they can get it out immediately to people without much introspection. Are you concerned as an author that more authors are not going to sit on facts and discoveries because they want to be, instant with that news? Does that concern you at all for your profession, or am I overstating it?
It the Well, it doesn't concern me about authors because I'm not alone in the sense that all authors are up against this problem because we're not in the news business per se. I think every writer who's in the, I'm not talking about fiction writers, that's different, but nonfiction, people who write adult nonfiction books, it's in all of our best interest to, you know, be restrained because we're trying to hold on to that information for the book. So the book has value when it comes out. But the point that you, the problem you bring up, I actually have more than one instance that I write about in the Dynasty where if you go to Deflategate, which is, you know, one of the biggest sports controversies of our time, the whole question of whether the Patriots purposely deflated footballs to gain a competitive advantage. That story, the reason it got so out of control and was ignited into this huge controversy is because of social media. I mean, there was, before there was any evidence that of any wrongdoing, it just was a few people, journalists, who went to social media with either erroneous information or with assumptions that they put out on social media platforms like Twitter that basically lit a fire that couldn't be put out. And so I dive into that pretty deep in the Dynasty because you see the ramifications of it. It's so different than the Spygate situation the Patriots faced back in 2007 where they were accused of filming the New York Jets and breaking rules. Deflategate was a completely different animal in terms of how it came about, how it was portrayed, and how it resulted. And social media played an unmistakable role in that, the abuse of social media. And so I think it's something that has embarrassed, it has caused embarrassment for journalism in general because of how many reporters use social media not to report real news, but to promote themselves. And I think that that's happened at the cost of the reputation of journalists far and wide. And so, I mean, it's one of the reasons, quite frankly, that I avoid social media in terms of, for the purpose of sort of reporting things.
I have to ask you about a phrase that we hear a lot today. And that is, and by the way, I just got to tell the listeners and viewers, it's a great section of your book where you talk about Deflategate. So it's a fantastic read. It's fascinating. But I have to ask you about a phrase that we hear a lot. It's called your truth, you know, follow your truth. Now, as a writer, I presume that you're always pursuing truth, right? Facts. Granted, you can throw in opinion and you can gather the opinion of your subjects, but in the end, you don't want to produce or print something that is factually incorrect. So I just want to ask you for your opinion about that term, your truth. How do you feel about that as an individual, Jeff, but also as a writer? Is there validity to that phrase, or does it take us down a different path?
I have to be honest, Rob, I haven't really thought about that phrase. I'm certainly familiar with it. You know, as a journalist, I've heard it tossed around a lot, particularly, you know, in the last year or so. But it's not a phrase that I've really thought too much about. But the concept that you're talking about in terms of trying to get to the truth, look, if we're being really candid, it's very difficult to get pure truth, especially when you're trying to go back in time and recreate something that happened in the past. So you have a series of things you can rely on. If you're lucky or fortunate, there might be some written record that you can go to, like journal entries, letters, news reports that were created in real time. That's helpful. If you can interview people who were there or who were involved, that's helpful. But the further you get away from the actual event, memories are a really tricky thing because people tend to not only forget things, but they actually misremember. And so a lot of times when you ask someone a question about something that happened in the past, It's not that they're purposely trying to mislead you. They actually remember things different than they were. And I see that all the time, even in my own experience. If I think about what I remember and then I consult what I wrote in my journal 20 years ago, I go, wow, I'm remembering it different than it happened. And so here's a perfect example of why I try to go about it the way I do when reconstructing the past. The dynasty, as you know, opens in the prologue in a very dramatic scene in a hospital room set in 2001, right after 9/11, when Drew Bledsoe, the quarterback at the time, is undergoing a procedure to save his life because he's bleeding internally. There are six people involved in this scene. There's Bledsoe, of course. There's his wife, who's there. There's the surgeon, who's operating on him. And then there's Tom Brady, Bill Belichick, and Robert Kraft, who are in the emergency room after Bledsoe wakes up from this life-saving procedure. So you have six people. To me, that was such an important moment, and I wanted to open the book with it, that I interviewed all six people about what happened in the room that night. Now, here's why that's valuable. Because first of all six of them remember different things about that night. They don't all remember the same thing. And it's not necessarily that what they remember is in contradiction with what someone else in the room remembered. It's just that when you talk about your truth, they remember different elements of that story. Maura Bledsoe, Drew's wife, obviously what she remembers is a bit different than what owner Robert Kraft remembers about that night. Because they had different points of priority and emphasis and emotion. So the benefit of talking to all six people who were in the room is I got the memories of all six of them. And the doctor, perhaps most importantly, the one who is literally cutting the incision in Drew's chest and inserting the instrument that's got to get in there to drain blood, what he was focused on that night, again, was very different than, say, what Tom Brady was focused on that night. I was trying to give the reader a multidimensional view of what was taking place in that room. It doesn't matter what I think about any of that. What matters is, what do those six people remember? And when you then integrate those six memories together, you get as complete of a picture as I think is possible. Is it perfect? No, it's not. Because first of all, I wasn't there and there's no video recording of it, but it's as close to the truth, I think, as I could get as a writer. And that's what I just try to set out. And sometimes you get closer than other times, but the point is for the reader is you've got to get as close as you can and feel at the end of the day that you can, with a straight face, say to the reader, I did my best here to show you what happened.
Thank you for relating that. I have another question related to professional athletes, and then I'd like to kind of go down a different path if we could. As we're conducting this interview and as you're promoting and interviewing with various media outlets regarding your book, The Dynasty, we're in the middle of heightened controversy related to the role of sports organizations, from leagues to teams, and of course, athletes, and their participation in social discussion. So some would say that keep the athletes out of this. You know, I don't go to an NFL game to be lectured to. I don't go to an NBA game to be told that I'm a racist or that I think different, that I think wrongly ideologically. On the other hand, some people will say, no, we have a captive audience at a moment like that. We have a national viewing audience, perhaps. And these players have terrific influence and they have prominence and they should be utilizing that, not just for personal gain, but for societal gain. So I'm not asking you to pick a side, Jeff, but you're so close to it because you know professional athletes and decision makers within the sports industry by name, personal friends with them, but you're also a fan yourself. You're a huge sports fan. So what insights have you gained in this period that we're going through right now? What have you learned from this? And do you have any cautionary notes that you would give us?
Well, my answer to that sort of, I think, very important question, because of the issues it raises, is that my perspective is actually goes all the way back to, I have to go back 25 years. My perspective isn't just framed by what's happened in the last 6 months. It really goes back to what I've been watching in the world of sports for 25 to 30 years as a journalist and as someone who's been involved in the industry, is that I think athletes, because of the, look, this is cultural. In our culture in America, we place such importance on athletics. It is such a deeply embedded part of society in America. Think about Little League and Pee Wee football and youth soccer. It just, scholarships for athletes who go to colleges. It is a huge part of American culture. We, not only do we adore athletics, but we place a great emphasis on athletics. And so to me, if we're going to hold athletes accountable as role models, meaning the example they set for youth, and we want our athletes to set a good example for kids because so many kids look up to him. You can't say that and then at the same time say that these athletes can't express their opinions and their thoughts about something that's so much more important than sports. I mean, when we start talking about issues of social justice, racism, poverty, the things that a lot of athletes, a lot of our top athletes have personal experience in those matters. To expect that they would not stand up and voice their concerns about some of these things that they've either experienced personally or seen and grown up around in their communities, to me, doesn't really make sense. I think that it's a good thing and a smart thing and a courageous thing, for that matter, when an athlete who knows he has children looking up to him or even adults is willing to speak up, especially in the responsible way that I think so many athletes have been trying to do this year. And do that. I mean, I think it would be, frankly, it's almost irresponsible not to, because they do have a platform. They do have a voice. And look, we can go back in history and look at athletes who have had the courage to stand up in the past, whether it's Arthur Ashe or Muhammad Ali. I mean, you can start making a list. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Bill Russell, there's a long line and tradition in this country of athletes taking risks during times of trouble and speaking out about issues that actually matter. Sports matter because we're all into it, but at the end of the day, those are games. They're games. I think the things that athletes talk about that involve things like when we talk about racism or social justice, those aren't games. I mean, these involve people's lives. And so if athletes can affect social change or affect people to sort of open their minds a little broadly, to look at situations and topics that sometimes are uncomfortable to talk about, I think that's a good thing. Look, on the one hand, when a player like LeBron James opens a school and then opens his wallet to finance the school, it's easy to applaud that, because everybody says, well, that's a great thing. But the minute that LeBron James talks about, say, police brutality, suddenly it's divisive. Half the people like it, half the people criticize him for it. I think it takes more courage to do that than to open a school, which obviously I'm a big advocate for the fact that he opened the school. But my point is, one's easy to do in terms of how public will perceive it, the other one's not. I think when you take a sport like the NFL, where 70% of those who play that sport are African American, and so many of those players have grown up with personal experiences, or they have family members and friends who have personal experiences with police brutality, how can they not talk about it? is really how I look at it. How can they not talk about it? And the NBA is in the same boat. And so I actually like the fact, Rob, that the NFL, starting with the commissioner and some of the owners, and Robert Kraft is one of them, they've gone through this process over the last 3 years where they're looking at this whole thing entirely different than they did when Colin Kaepernick first took a knee. It's looked at differently today than it was back then. It's taken some time to get there, but I think the further we get away in time from when Kaepernick took the knee, I think that there's only going to be more understanding about why so many players have come out and are speaking out in one form or another about what is clearly a very serious issue in America right now.
Well, I think the earlier discussion we were having about truth, you know, your truth, finding your truth, has a lot of application to this subject. Because as you mentioned, in the example of the operating room, when Drew Bledsoe was being operated on, there were six people who all had a different memory or perspective. And so I think that is the needle that needs to be threaded, is that we as an industry, in the sports industry, have to understand that everyone has their own truth. So some people totally understand what the athletes are saying or trying to say because they've been there before. They relate to it.
Yes.
As you just suggested. And other people don't understand what the athletes are trying to say because it's a different world for them. So hopefully the industry will find ways to speak to all audiences. And it's a pivotal moment right now. It's,
it's
critical that we're right.
You're right. In fact, Rob, one of my favorite anecdotes in the dynasty, and you probably remember this, but Robert Kraft is, you know, a wealthy white man who owns an NFL team. He doesn't have personal experience with what a lot of the African-American players in the NFL have been talking about for the last 3 years. What's interesting to me, and this is why I wrote this in the book, is in an effort to understand more, he did something that no other owner has done. And I wish all of them would do something like this. He visited Meek Mill in prison in Philadelphia. Meek Mill, a very famous rapper who was arrested and accused of pointing a gun at a police officer. That's not a unique situation for a young black man in an American city, unfortunately. What is unusual is that the owner of a football team in New England bothered to go and visit him in prison, get to know him, learn his upbringing and his experience, and then go to bat for him. Join up with someone like Jay-Z and advocate for Meek Mill. And the reason I included that story, you say, why would you put a story like that in a book about a football team? Because it's related to the whole Black Lives Matter movement. And it's a different look at how somebody learns about someone who's different than them. They're a different color, they've come from a different background, and they've had an entirely different experience with law enforcement. The only way we're ever going to build these bridges, Rob, is we've got to talk to each other. We've got to be willing to sort of hear people who have an experience that's entirely different than ours. And I think sports is a perfect platform for that. It's one of the only places in America where the color of your skin or how much money you make or what neighborhood you grew up in or what religion you are doesn't matter. That's what makes sports such a beautiful thing. And if you have an owner like that or a coach who's willing to make those kinds of efforts to understand other people, I think it also provides a roadmap of how we could navigate through some of these thorny issues that we're grappling with right now as a society.
As you're talking about those incidences, those examples, if I can shift just a little bit, it reminds me that everybody has a story, right? And I've got a friend, a very close friend who runs his own podcast. Roger Brooks is his name. And that's his tagline is everyone has a story. You are in the business of discovering people's stories, Jeff. And you've been doing this for decades. We at Game Face Execs Podcast, we hope that a lot of different people listen and watch this episode and all of our episodes. But we've been very vocal that we're really focusing on those people who want to be better persuaders and better influencers and better motivators of whether it's a family or if it's with your significant other or it's the company that you run or the sales department that you're in. When it comes to Everybody Has a Story, you have learned, I presume, how to enjoy and appreciate other people's stories. It's reflected in what you've been sharing with us today. How would you guide or counsel people who are persuaders or who want to be better persuaders in their industry or in their company or their organization? How would you advise them to become more aware of other people's stories, to appreciate other people's stories, and to pull those stories out of their colleagues or out of those people that they manage?
I mean, my personal experience is that the best persuaders are the best listeners. And in my job as a biographer, as someone who tries to understand success and write books about people who have become the best in their thing, better than anyone else, whether it's a person or a company, is I go into these projects with absolutely, I try to have no judgment about people. I don't want to, come in with preconceptions. I want to learn about people who are different than me. That's what's fascinating. I'm not trying to convince people to be more like me or to think the way I think. I want to understand who they are and how they think. So the most important skill probably for me is listening. I try to listen to people. I try to watch and observe and really understand them and get their perspective of things. It really enables, from a writing standpoint, is a more multidimensional view and understanding of who they are or who the business is. And so it's less about me and more about them. And I think that's a portable or transferable skill set in terms of, even if you're just, look, you can't necessarily get along with everybody. That just isn't going to happen. You're going to have differences of opinion and stuff like that. But I think in terms of influencing people, so much of that starts with listening and understanding. And it has to be genuine. Like people can perceive whether you're giving lip service to them or whether you genuinely want to hear from them and understand them and their perspective. And I think as a journalist, if people get the perception that I'm not genuine, then they're not going to really open up to me and share the information and the stories with me that I need to do my job. And so I don't know if that part can be taught. I'm just intellectually curious. I like to know. And I always feel like, frankly, whether I'm talking to a janitor or someone who works security detail, or whether I'm talking to a president or a CEO, there's something to learn. And I value the interview with the janitor or the security guard because he doesn't have to talk to me any more than the CEO doesn't have to talk to me. And so that's just how I view it. And that's how I try to go about what I do as a journalist.
So in closing, Jeff, can you share with us, because you have sat down with the Warren Buffetts of the world and the Tiger Woods of the world and presidential candidates and politicians and leaders of industry. Is there one person, if you wouldn't mind sharing, one person or perhaps one company, one brand, that as much as you tried not to go in with preconceived opinions, after meeting them and visiting with them, you walked out of that meeting or out of that multi-day interview and you said, man, that person surprised me. I did not expect to find that. I did not expect they would be what they turned out to be. Is there one particular example that you might share with us?
I mean, I could point to many examples, Rob, but because where my mind is right now is the New England Patriots organization, because that's where I've sort of been embedded for the last 2 years. Certainly the example that is most at the forefront of my mind today would be Robert Kraft, and the owner of the New England Patriots, who was a complete stranger when I approached him about wanting to write this book. But having had the opportunity for the last 2 years to interview him extensively and to maybe more importantly, observe him for the last 2 years in a wide range of different environments, to see his management style, to see his executive approach, to see how he deals with people, how he deals with conflict, how he deals with adversity, how he deals with success, I would say him. I didn't have an appreciation for the complexity and the difficulty of running a world-class professional sports franchise, because I've never had the privilege of profiling an owner before. And so with him, it was almost like a jaw-dropping learning experience every time I was around him. And I think that benefit, that luxury of being able to observe him and also his son, Jonathan, who's also a senior executive in the Patriots organization, two of the best in the history of the industry. It was filled with surprise. And I'm grateful, obviously, that they allowed me the opportunity to do that and to tell that story in the book.
Well, and we're grateful, Jeff, that you took the time to visit with me and our listeners and our viewers. This has been a very rewarding conversation with you. Once again, we'd encourage everyone to grab not only the Dynasty, there's so many great insights and stories and lessons that we can all take from it, but also any of Jeff's other best-selling books. And we'll obviously make those available to our listeners and our viewers on our various platforms. But thank you, Jeff. This has been awesome. We wish you the best of luck. Any last suggestions you'd give to any of us on how we can best get the book right now?
I mean, the book is available everywhere, Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com. And I'm a big proponent, obviously, of local independent bookstores, especially during this pandemic. So many of these local bookstores in anybody's home communities, they've been hit the hardest. And so I've been encouraging people where possible to buy the book from a local store and help their local business.
Great advice. Well, best of luck to you, Jeff. Yeah, can you give us a peek into your next book, or is that still under wraps?
It's still under wraps, and I'm trying not to think about that right now.
Well, thanks again, Jeff. Hope to see you on the road sooner than later.
Thank you, Rob. It was a privilege.
Thanks for being a part of this episode of Game Face Execs. If you found any of it useful or helpful, please rate or like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. I always appreciate you referring us to others as well. I'll see you next week. Until then, persuade, influence, inspire.